Good afternoon. I'm calling this meeting of the Taxes Committee to order for March 21st, 2024. We do have a quorum present. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes for March 19th, 2024. Representative Norris, do we have a motion?
Chair Gomez, I move adoption of the March 19th minutes from the Taxes Committee.
Vice Chair Norris has moved adoption of the minutes for March 19th. Is there any discussion on the motion? Not seeing any. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? No. Motion carries.
Whoa.
Oh.
Flag objects.
Well,
are you trying to take out our lead here?
I think we can't even get into any of the symbolism of what just happened. We're just going to pretend nothing happened. Representative David.
I have checked the flag and it's okay.
Wonderful. Great news. Okay. Thank you for being here, everyone.
Good start, everyone.
So we're going to hear about, first of all, we're going to hear from Commissioner Marquardt about the governor's tax supplemental budget recommendations. Then we're going to have a presentation after that about implementation of the local aid for preventing homelessness. So first we're going to move to Commissioner Marquardt. Welcome back to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Paul Marquardt, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And it's nice to be here, honored to be able to present the governor's supplemental tax budget for this year. And I know, Madam Chair, you have a full agenda, so we'll move through these because there isn't really any, I don't think, big surprises, primarily a couple new things on the child tax credit. So. So I will start, so we can go on to the next one there. So the child tax credit, of course, started this year, was a major priority of Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, and the legislature, and it's up to $1,750 per child, refundable, and the real exciting part is if we do this right, it can cut child poverty by 33%. And I won't read any more other than give you an update, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As of 7:30 this morning, $387 million had been claimed at this point on the child tax credit and benefiting 320,000 children. So we're on pace, and when you think about the benefit that things and programs can have, this is a big one. Next, on the advanced, so as part of the legislation last year on the child tax credit, it authorized the commissioner to look at designing an advanced periodic payment plan. And I know that was a top priority for the legislature. And so working with advocates and others, that will start next year. There's the advanced, that'll be for tax year 24, filing 25 will be the start of an advanced periodic payment system. There you can see the benefits of doing that. I mean, studies show that by doing periodic payments where you're matching really kind of the payment periods with the needs of paying for necessities and those type of things really enhances the ability of the child tax credit to cut child poverty by 33%. So this is really crucial. Minnesota would be the first state in the nation to do an advanced tax credit. Not all the details have been worked out, a lot of working with advocates and others, but just exactly how those periodic payments would go out. But it would, you know, the federal government did an advanced payment on the child tax credits back in 2021, if you remember. But it provided a lot of benefits to folks. So what are some of the, what would be some of the mechanics, if you will, of an advanced periodic child tax credit? Is first of all, it would be opt-in. You would have to opt-in to be part of that. And we know that education's going to be a big part of that because there is an interaction with various federal programs like SNAP that would count against income if you take periodic payments. So there's going to be an education component that is going to be big. The advanced periodic tax credit would be 50% of your previous year's credit. So if you filed this year and you had two children, qualified for the maximum of $3,500 for those two children, your advanced payments would equal one half of that, or $1,750. That will start next year. We want people to participate in the Advanced Periodic Child Tax Credit Program. And one of the big obstacles when you had the advanced earned income tax credit that went from 1979 to 2011, only 3% got involved. And one of the big reasons was the fear of, you know, if you get increase in income or something, having to pay everything back at the end. And that kept a lot of folks out. And we know the more people we can keep in the advanced credit, the more likely we're going to get to that 33% child poverty cut, and what a benefit that will be. And so what we have here is a guaranteed credit on your child tax credit. And here again are some of the benefits. As I mentioned, it would increase participation in that advanced credit, increase more certainty and predictability, and minimize the risk of a repayment. So let's move to the next slide to kind of talk about a little bit more about how it would work. So I want to say that this would involve a change. So basically, it's a payment protection pilot. This would go in the governor's budget. He has proposed a four-year pilot program, and the cost is $45 million. It would be one time set up into a special fund with MMB, and then each year the department would come back and say, here's what was spent, and then that would be sent to the general fund. So that's a big part of it, but it just involves income changes. So if the number of children would happen to change, you don't qualify for that kind of protection. It's only income, because that's really the one that you might be the most uncertain about. And we also want parents not to have to worry about taking a promotion or taking extra or having a spouse find a job. We want them to be able to do that without fear of having this repayment at the end. So what we do, this would automatically apply when you're filing your tax return. There is an income cap. So if you are married, one child, the income cap is $60,100. If you're above that, you don't qualify for this payment plan protection. But for each child, that goes up by $9,000. So if you have two children, it'd be $69,100, and the singles $49,000. So again, it's $45 million. The Department of Revenue is also planning to have a portal set up. And this would be a portal that parents could go on to. Let's say they see, oh boy, I'm going to really get knocked off of qualifying for this. They could get into this portal so we can, you know, actually try to prevent some of this on the front end by allowing parents the option to kind of opt out as the year is going on. And by the way, the federal government in 2021 also had a similar, I guess, safe harbor type of an approach. And that was basically if you were under 40,000 single, you didn't have to pay anything back. And then it phased out up to 80,000. And for married, it was at 60,000 and under. And then it went to 120,000. It phased out. So this is something the federal government had also. All right, just to take you through a few scenarios. And I know I'm kind of going through this quickly, and slow me down. I know you've got a lot of things going on, but we can open it up for questions here. But this might be the best to kind of show how this would work with the advance payment. So in this scenario, we're going to say there's no change in income or the number of children from year to year. So let's say you qualify for two children. You get the maximum. You're under $35,000, you'll say married. You'd receive the $1,750 times two, $3,500 in a child tax credit in 2024, which you would claim when you're filing in 25 for tax year 24. You then would say, you'd check a box, I opt in to the periodic or advance payment. And we haven't decided when those payments would start. You'd first of all get that $3,500 right now when you filed your taxes in February or March or whenever. And then you would get half of that $3,500 in advance payment. So one thing we think is really good with the design right now is we're always basing that advance credit off of numbers we already know that people have already filed with. So we know those numbers. And so now on this, you'd be able to qualify for $1,750. We don't know for sure, but let's say it would start in July. It could be monthly payments, could be quarterly, every 2 months. But you would get that $1,750 from July through December in this scenario. So when you would come back to file the next year, there's no change. You qualify for $3,500 again. Since you already received $1,750, when you actually file, you'd get $1,750. The paycheck protection, the payment protection pilot would not qualify here because you didn't drop below that 50%. And so then you would also qualify for another $1,750 because $3,500 is kind of your base. So let's move to the next scenario. This one, the payment protection pilot will apply. Same scenario, $3,500. You get $1,750 in advance, which is 50% of your credit that you have qualified for. But let's say you had an increase in income. And so when you go to file the next year, instead of qualifying for $3,500, because of your income, you only qualify for $1,000. Your advance payment was $1,750 the year before. Since that $1,000 is less than that $1,750, that payment protection plan would kick in at that point and cover that $750. So you wouldn't have to pay that $750 back as long as your income level was under the required amount. The next year, your base is $1,000, so now you'd be able to qualify for a $500 advance payment because it's half of what you have qualified for. Again, if the taxpayer's income, in this case, because they have two children married, if it's above $69,100, you would not qualify for the payment protection pilot. So that's, I apologize for kind of going over that quickly, and some of this, like on the advanced payment, is still in design, but the plan, it would start when folks file next year. But do you want, Madam Chair, I take questions now before I move on, because if folks have questions at all on this.
I do have a couple of folks on the list. I don't know, Representative Joy and Representative Robbins, if you wanted to ask a question now or if you want to hold it till the end of the presentation, up to you.
I can hold mine till the end.
Okay. Sure. Representative Robbins?
Mine's on this, but if we can come back to this, I'm fine.
I think you should go ahead. Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Marquardt. Nice to see you. So this protection plan, this is all new, right? This is the first time we're hearing about this?
Madam Commissioner Chair, Representative Robin, yes, this was in the governor's proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner and Madam Chair. So I'll have a lot of further questions, but just like at first blush, this seems incredibly complicated and a lot of work for the department and a lot of hoops to jump through rather than just doing a sliding scale. Because if the point is that we don't want people to be disincentivized to earn more income or to better their skills or whatever, it seems like we have a lot more experience with just doing a sliding scale than doing this. So why wouldn't we do the sliding scale approach?
Yeah. Commissioner Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins. We've looked at a number of different approaches to this, and right now, just administratively, they think this would be probably the most clear cut on this. So you're just, because you're just going back to your, what you have qualified for your credit. And basically, if what you qualify the next year is half, less than half of that, then this just, you're assured of that, always that half of that. And you'll automatically just calculate that as you do your taxes. So there is somewhat of a sliding scale, of course, because with married with one child, the cutoff is 60,100. Then it actually goes up 9,000 for each child. So there is somewhat, I guess, of a sliding scale, if you would. But we believe me, at the Department of Revenue, we're always looking at how we can administrate things as simple as possible. And this is kind of the plan, and advocates also think this is a good approach.
Representative Robbins, would you mind, just for my own curiosity, because I want to understand your question, like when you talk about a sliding scale, can you just say a little bit more about that?
Sure. So, yeah. Like, generally, when we have a phase out, as your income rises, you lose a percentage of benefits, but it mm-hmm. ticks down gradually. Mm-hmm. Here, because there's a hard cutoff at 69,100, but yet you can get half the credit, and if your income goes up, to me, this just seems like incredibly overly complicated, so I was just concerned of why we're not doing the sliding scale, which we do in many other benefit programs.
So, I mean, we can go to Mr. Williams if you want, but I mean, this there is, of course, like a phase out that was designed in this program to ensure that there aren't cliffs and that we aren't doing that, stacking of phase outs for different refundable income tax credits. My understanding, I guess, is that this is more income targeted. I mean, in part, just to control the cost, just to be totally frank, and because we know that, this actually, like, when you get into having more children, the phase out does increase pretty generously, and so my perception, I guess, is that when the federal government was doing periodic payments for child tax credits, I don't know if you guys all heard, but maybe it's just because, like, tax lady, but I heard from so many people, from so many constituents about, especially low-income people, about how, like, man, getting $3,000 or $4,000 or $6,000 or $1,000 extra a month for those child tax credits, it really, really made a difference. And so I think, like, the reason that this doesn't apply to every single person who's going to get the child tax credit ultimately, and some people would not be able to opt into the periodic payments if they didn't meet those income requirements, was really, most of the reason that we do income targeting is because we want to ensure that, like, with the resources that we have to spend on a program, we're making the most impact in the lives of those people who kind of need it the most. So, I want us to do this for everybody who's able to income qualify for this credit and who's in the entire phase out. But I think the reason that it does have that income cap was just, like, about controlling the cost of the program in a year when we just don't have, like, a ton of ongoing money. And we're trying to make, I don't want to speak for the governor's office about why the cutoff was there, but that's my perception.
So,
Commissioner Marker.
Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, and Madam Chair, you're correct. I mean, a lot is just a matter of kind of dollars. Right now, this pilot program would be, the revenue estimate would be about $10 million a year. And of course, the child tax credit, there is a sliding scale, of course, but just on this part of the program, there is that cutoff there. So.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the discussion and also the cost. That was one of my questions. And just to be clear, so you said that they wouldn't have to repay, in the example you gave, they wouldn't have to repay the $750. So is it sort of functioning like guaranteed basic income? Is that what this kind of is like a test case for?
Commissioner Marquardt.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, so the whole idea is to make sure we keep participation up in the advanced credit because we know how valuable that is. And so what we're just trying to provide is a floor so that people can increase their income, they can get, a spouse can get a job and they don't have to worry. So is it a guarantee of a certain amount? Absolutely. It's saying that you're guaranteed at least half of your credit from the year before, based on income, not if the number of children changes, but just based on that income, because we know that if we can do that, we increase the participation we can really, really reduce that child poverty.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I think that means that's a yes. We're testing guaranteed basic income in a small way with this pilot program. And I would just say, you know, I want everyone to be well aware of the implications of that. And I personally, I support the child credit and the phase out and all of that, but that is a bridge too far for me. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to make a just brief comment on the universal basic income piece, because, you know, I think this is really about ensuring that, like, if somebody's situation changes, I mean, these are lower income people that we're talking about overall who are served by this program. You know, the phase out begins at $35,000 a year, right? So that is well below our average income, well below the income that a lot of us are making. So, you know, if somebody it does in those scenarios that the commissioner talked about, if somebody does, you know, manage to increase their income, the year after, when they're receiving these periodic payments, which again just can really be a lifeline for low income families, we're just saying, like, then they don't have to dig into that amount of money that they were able to increase their income by to pay back something that happened basically through no fault of their own. Because that, you know, that income not, or them basically like owing that money to us, it's not because they did anything wrong. It's not because they, you know, even miscalculated anything. It's just because their financial situation changed year over year. And so this is a safe harbor and a hold harmless clause like we have, honestly, in a lot of different places in across our state budget. You know, if when financial situations change, when something goes, you know, when we're kind of like changing policy, we try to ensure that we're holding people harmless. And so that's what this is. I don't personally think that it's a, you know, universal basic income pilot. It's really just making sure that, you know, if somebody gets a child tax credit, they're a low-income person, their income goes up, they don't owe that money back to the Department of Revenue. Because that's a really hard situation to be in, you know, if for a low-income family trying to raise kids. Something like $700 or $800, having to then to pay that back when you have just in good faith participated in a program that we're designing to improve people's lives and make their, you know, make it a little bit easier for them to meet their bills month to month. I have a list, so I'm going to go
to this point.
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have to go to a meeting in the Capitol like right now. So during your eloquent speech, I didn't want you to think I was getting up and leaving. I'm not going mad. I'm just going away.
Sounds good, Representative Davis.
Infirmary to scar in his back.
Can I go get stitches?
We can take care of that right here. Thank you, Representative Davis. Okay, so I know that I think Representative Anderson, you had a question on this point. So Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two questions. When we say pilot, so is it everyone that's in that income level is in the pilot, or is it a smaller select group of people?
Commissioner Mark.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, great question. Everyone who is receiving the child tax credit, whether or not you take the advance payment or the lump sum, would qualify for the payment protection pilot.
Representative Anderson.
So okay. Everyone who's in the program.
Okay, thank you. And then how is the department going to handle, there are some divorced couples that they each take turns claiming the kids. There are marriages that occur during years. There are things that make significant changes where they wouldn't even be eligible for anything, not even, you know, because of their income. How's the department going to handle that when those things occur?
Commissioner
Madam
Mark Bart.
Chair, Representative Anderson, and that's another issue we've talked quite a bit about. Right now, the plan is just to stay to what was filed when they went to file, whatever that status was. That is what the advance payment will be based on.
Okay. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Anderson. Mm-hmm. Great. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question this is great, and I think the impact you're trying to have with these periodic payments, as we've discussed, I think is awesome to think about that. And I just wanted to know a little bit about, you know, we did the child tax credit last year, the $45 million in fiscal year 25. Can you just say a little bit more about why that funding specifically versus what we did with the child care tax credit funding last year? I mean, I just want to make sure I'm fully understanding why we need the $45 million. I think I do, but I want to know for sure. Thank
Commissioner,
you.
Great. Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, in ways and means, Chair
right.
Olson, I understand that question. So this is above and beyond because just like the one scenario that was given, that according to state statute, that person would receive $1,000, but now they're guaranteed $1,750. So the revenue estimate says right now that about 20,500 of the 300,000 potential filers would receive this payment at an average of about $480. But that's where the increase, and it's about $10 million a year.
Chair Olson? Great. Representative Kosnick, did you want to ask something now?
Yeah, if I could just get clarification on it. So it's $45 million would be appropriated from the general fund to set up the pilot program, and we don't – I'm trying to understand the cost, and then you were referencing a $10 million. If you could clarify that, and then just one other quick question. Thanks.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick. So right now it's looking at 4 years. The estimate is like the first year, $9.8 million, then $10 million. And so 4 years, that's about $40 million. There's a little extra just in case. So it could be less than that ultimately.
Representative Kosnick?
But Madam Chair, Commissioner, thank you. I knew I was hearing the $10 million, but I can do multiplication, simple multiplication. So that makes sense to me. So we hear a lot about reducing the childhood poverty by 33%. Great talking point. Who would be against that? How are we going to measure that? Are there certain, are we putting in statute what the metrics are so that we can do that, or is this just something that we're going to talk about?
So, Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, that is right to the point. And so when Columbia University looked at it, they were using Minnesota at 6.9% child poverty rate, and that this would reduce it to 4.6%, which was a 33% decrease. We're actually using a supplemental poverty rate. There is a specific group within the One Minnesota plan and budget that we meet consistently, and we've looked at that. And so, like I said, we're going to use the supplemental poverty level, and, you know, ever how that measurement comes out every year, but that's what we're going to base it. So it is this, and it certainly is wonderful to talk about reducing poverty 33%, but we actually have to get there. And believe me, that's a huge concern. When you're investing, this child tax credit is $400 million a year. That's by far the largest investment I've ever seen in one single program. And the idea is to reduce that child poverty, because if we can do it, you know, we know the benefits of it. It's huge as far as outcomes for children and improving education, health care outcomes, and all those type of things, which, you know, can not only enhance our workforce, make for a better economy, but can lower health care costs and just make families more stable. So, I mean, your question right there is the heart of everything that we're doing. And the governor, Lieutenant Governor, and I know legislature's watching very closely. We are dedicated to getting to that number.
Madam Representative
Chair,
Kosnick.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, thank you for that clarification. And I was aware that it was based on a study at Columbia University. But I'm not – is there going to be in statute metrics to measure this, a report back to the legislature or not?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, there's nothing in the legislature legislation right now, and I don't know what the plans are to report that to the public. I guess I've been one, and I know is for transparency, and I think people need to know how this is working. It may not be in the first year. We don't know. It may take, you know, a few years. We know just on the long-term impact is going to be somewhat generational. But I think you should be able to see some very clear reductions early on. And that's why our outreach is so important, Representative Kosnick and members of the committee, is because we think about 30,000 have never filed taxes before, all that 300,000. And if we're actually going to get that 33%, we've got to get to everyone. We can't just throw a program out there and hope people will file. So.
Thank you, Commissioner. And just I'll go back to you, but wanted to, and I know that we have our family and children's chair here, which is wonderful, so he probably has some insight for us. But just that child poverty is a metric that is tracked. That metric comes, my understanding is a bunch of it comes out of the American Community Survey, which is like the census analysis that happens every year where they track like the same people over time. And that they're able to, you know, make an analysis based on that data. I was really interested when we were doing the federal periodic payments were happening for the federal child tax credit, that they were able to provide monthly child poverty data, so they could say, like, you know, to kind of try to isolate what the impact of that was month to month on the level of child poverty in our country. I don't know that we're going to have that kind of information for the state, but just that it is it's a metric that we track. It's certainly something that people who are making policy about families and children, that the Department of Human Services, I've seen them, you know, publish data about that. I read this very interesting report about people living in deep poverty a few years ago that had a lot of different ways of looking at the poverty level, particularly of families and children. So I want to go over to Chair Pinto and see if he has anything more to add, because I think this is a really important question that you're asking.
It is. Thank you, Chair. And actually, what you said was really helpful in figuring something out for me. So because Representative Kosnick, as you asked your question, I thought to myself, I'm trying to think about the value of knowing that information, because I understand the concern about the rhetoric, right, that there's this description of it reduces poverty by that amount. As the commissioner said, there's really good research that is true, and figuring out the exact reduction in poverty in our state is not a simple matter. As the chair says, we do measure poverty. I suspect we've got measures of child poverty. Attributing a change in child poverty to this particular change starts getting really complicated, right? Maybe in the next couple of years, the economy, I'm going to be all hopeful for all of us, the economy gets even stronger, right? But maybe that wasn't about, maybe a portion of reduction in child poverty is not about this. Maybe the economy gets a lot worse and there's actually, child poverty doesn't decrease by nearly as much. And yet, actually, if you just look at this, it really did have the impact. So the decision we made, to my mind, was informed by a lot of research. Adding to that research in Minnesota costs money, is complicated. And so we have to decide as a legislature, do we want to spend money to find out the exact amount the poverty is reduced in children to measure against things, and then sort of what would we even do with that information? The research says, and it's really good, sound research for many years, that it's a massive reduction. What the research says is about a third. And whether it turns out to be 31% or 36%, I don't know that that's actionable. I don't know if it'd be worth spending public resources on that exactly, versus figuring out, hey, how well did it get into the hands of families? What's going on? All the mechanics of that, absolutely. But the reduction in child poverty, I'm just not sure that it adds much. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner and Representative Pinto. I get it that it might be complicated, and if you, to use your words, it's not a simple measure, and research is nice, but we're investing over $400 million, and the taxpayers want to know if this is effective. So just, you know, whether, if you even got to 30%, not 33, I think that would be a success. But what I'm failing to see is any metrics explained here today. It's not in the statute. I don't perceive or understand that it will be in the enacting statute of this program that we're talking about today. And so taxpayers want some accountability. I don't care if it's complicated. Just regular research that's nice doesn't get us there. When we're spending taxpayer dollars in this amount of money, we need to know if it's actually doing what it's being purported to do, to reduce. And like, again, if you're saying 33%, then I want to see 33%. If you come up a little shy, I think we can have a little grace in that. But just to say, well, we're just going to have some more research and feel good about it, doesn't cut it for taxpayers.
Representative Lee.
Thank
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also sit on the Children and Families Committee, and someone who has been tracking the child tax credit for many years as someone who worked in Congress. And so I did just want to comment that in statute, we do have the federal poverty rate defined. Unfortunately, due to, political wins, that the federal poverty rate actually has not been updated as it should be. There have been numerous congressional reports about how inaccurate of a measure it is at measuring poverty and child poverty. And so I just want to offer, there is a statute that hasn't been updated because people in Congress refuse to do that. And so that is not an accurate measure. I also want to offer that in lieu of that, there are institutions like Columbia University and other higher ed institutions that have actually done the work and done their research to provide accurate measures of what child poverty means, right, and what poverty means in the United States. And so, if we want to have this debate in Minnesota, it would be great to define what it means to live in poverty, and hopefully, our federal counterparts will update what it means to be poor on the federal level. And I know we take we usually follow our federal tax folks, right, on defining what it means. I also just want to add color to this discussion that appreciate what Rep. Kosnick is trying to do. We do need to get to the bottom of it, but there are other things that we have to do before that. And so, thanks.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? All right. We will go back to Commissioner Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is excellent discussion. And I will say that I have been at several meetings with the governor, with the governor's office, and they are asking, where are you at with the data and making sure we've got the outreach? We have an internal data dashboard that is updated every day at about 7 o'clock in the morning. That's where I'm getting the stats. But you can look at it by zip code, the number that have gotten the credit and how much. So we know areas that counties that have higher percent of child poverty. We're looking right now, is the zip code, is it matching? We also roughly know the number of kids, so we can somehow get a barometer. So this has been very deliberate, very analytical, because Representative Kosnick is right on. We need, absolutely, with this investment to the public, the idea is not only to get to a number of 33%, but just improve family stability and improve educational outcomes, healthcare outcomes. I mean, all of these things. There's studies that look at the savings, or I should say the cost of child poverty to the GDP. And a lot of studies say it could cost 2 to 5% of GDP because of lost work productivity, higher costs, and so forth. So we're looking at that. But I appreciate that because, and we've got a lot of experts around here on children and so forth. And this is a huge, huge topic that we're taking very seriously, very seriously.
Thank you.
So thank you. I guess we can go through the rest maybe pretty quickly. I know we're for attachments and appurtenances. Have we ever talked about this one before, Madam? I think we hopefully, basically in the language, we're changing. I think we're taking out the words attachment and appurtenances and replacing it with distribution systems. So there you go. Next, we'll move on. No, the corporate net operating loss. I think I know the House, 5 or 6 minutes the other day, Representative Leslegard. I think, I don't know if the Senate's taking that up when they are, but whatever. So certainly that is going to get done in one way, shape, or form, and that will be nice to get that done. There's just the next one is just a slight change on tribal nation aid. This 1 year to June 20th, and then after that, moving from December 26th to July 20th. And that will then be the same day as LGA and CPA, and those go out. And the last one is kind of a little bit of inside baseball. There's a research credit that hospitals and other type of medical groups can apply against the health care fee, and that has been set at 0.5% for a long time, and this just keeps it at 0.5%. So that is the governor's supplemental tax budget for this year, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to present this.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Marquardt. So we're moving to member questions now. First up, Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Marquardt. One of the questions on line 45 is tax aid credits. Emergency ambulance service aid is, I think it's $10 million. Can you explain what that $10 million is going to be used for?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you so much, Madam Chair, Representative Joyce. So it's, I don't know if that's going to wind up in the language here for sure, but whether or not or in another committee, but my understanding of it is that it's $10 million one time, and it's targeted to those ambulance services that I think have operating losses, and I see Ms. Bears next to me, of $1 million or more. And I don't know if there's other qualification. I think you have to be on a list of licensed ambulance services and so forth, but it's targeted to, I think, $1 million or more of loss operating.
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. Commissioner Marquardt, Madam Chair. So it's going to be used basically for ambulance services running a deficit, correct?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Joy, that's my understanding, yes.
Okay, and then?
Representative Joy.
Who would qualify for that, like which ambulance service, or how do we pick that?
Commissioner Marquardt.
Madam Chair, Representative Joy, I don't have that information.
Okay. I will just.
We can certainly get that to folks very quickly.
I will just mention, Representative Joy, that the EMS aid has had a hearing in the Health Committee last week, maybe, mm-hmm. And it's been referred to taxes. So we're figuring out if we will either hear it in property taxes, and then it will be included in the division report, and then it will be in front of us, or it will have a hearing directly here. But in either case, we will have a chance since it is a property tax aid and credit. As the tax committee, we'll absolutely have a chance to vet it, and so we'll get answers to all those questions. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
All right. Is there any other questions for the commissioner before we move him off the hot seat? I'm not seeing any. Thank you so much, Commissioner and Ms. Bears, for being with us and for bringing this budget forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, members. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I just wanted to. Mr. Williams is giving me a little bit of information, Representative Kosnick, about your question. And so we're going to just, share some more information about the kind of the data used in analyzing that supplemental poverty rate and what we think we can anticipate moving forward in terms of kind of more information that will come out once our child tax credit is fully implemented. So we'll be following up on that point.
Madam Chair, I'm glad that the committee is being taped so I can rewatch it, but I also will take out my notepad and anxiously scribble some notes on what metrics we're using or not.
All right. Sounds good, Representative Kosnick. Okay. So next up, we are going to have an overview of the county aid for prevention of homelessness. I'm like trying to remember what the actual name of this thing is, but local homeless prevention aid. Mr. Swanson has it. So first we're going to hear, we're really honored to be joined today by some folks from counties around the state who are going to share with us the details of how they're using these resources, these new resources. And so we're looking forward to that part, but first we're going to hear from Mr. Swanson, just sort of a brief overview of the program to remind us all what we're talking about. Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, members, Jared Swanson with House Research. As the Chair said, I'm just going to give a brief background presentation on local homeless prevention aid. Members should have copies of the slides in their packets. The packets also include the most recent distributions of the aid, so there should be two separate sheets of paper for that, one that shows the distributions to all the counties, and then another run that shows the distributions of the aid to the tribal governments. So the local homeless prevention aid was originally enacted in the 2021 tax bill and began actually making aid distributions in calendar year 2023. Those distributions will continue annually through 2028, after which time the aid sunsets. The original version of the aid that was enacted in 21 distributed funds only to counties, but the 2023 tax bill added tribal governments to the distributions of the aid as well. So currently, the counties will receive distributions of $17.6 million in aid annually, And each county's aid amount is based on a formula that includes population and then the share of students experiencing homelessness within the county. The tribal government distribution is equal to $2.4 million annually, and the aid to tribal governments is split equally among any of the tribal governments that opt into receiving the aid. Proceeds from the aid distributions must be used to fund new or existing family homeless prevention and assistance projects or programs. Those projects and programs may be administered either by a county, a city, a tribal government, or a community-based nonprofit organization. These programs and projects can also be operated jointly by any of these jurisdictions. So, for example, a program that's administered jointly by two neighboring counties could be funded by the aid. The projects and programs must target families with children and unaccompanied youth, and must do things like connect them with social services related to housing and provide various forms of housing support. Counties may choose not to spend all or a portion of the aid they receive. Any unspent funds are added back into the distribution of the aid for the following year. And finally, beginning in 2025, then every 2 years after that, the Commissioner of Revenue must produce a report on the projects and programs that are funded by the aid, and included in the report must be the number of people served by each project that's funded with the aid dollars, and an assessment of how each project or program impacts people who are currently experiencing homelessness or who are at risk of experiencing homelessness. And Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of the aid.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. So we do have the runs in your packets, but we don't have copies of his slides, I think. So, but we'll email them out, and I know Mr. Swanson's certainly open to answering any questions that anybody has. I don't know if there's anybody. Sorry, I didn't mean to. I missed my list. Is there any questions before we turn to testimony? All right. Not seeing any. Thank you, Mr. Swanson. So first up on my list, I have Lauren Ryan. On deck, Linnea Mersch. And I guess Mr. Hilgart's going to be our cruise director here. Welcome. Please just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thanks for being here.
Chair Gomez and members of the committee, my name is Lauren Ryan. I am a principal planning analyst with Hennepin County. And I am the project lead for our school to housing program, which is funded by the local homeless prevention aid. Hennepin County firmly believes that each of our 1.3 million residents deserve a safe and dignified place to call home. And we aim to make homelessness rare, brief, and non-recurring. We've struggled to ensure that housing is accessible and affordable for all. On behalf of the county, I want to thank you for the significant infusion of funding from last session to create affordable housing options for all Minnesotans. I'm here to share some good news about how Hennepin County will spend both the new affordable housing aid and also to discuss our local homeless prevention aid funds. Annually, we expect to receive $29 million in housing aid and $5 million in local homelessness prevention aid. In short, this funding will be used to supercharge our efforts to produce more affordable housing units, and it will help tailor the units to several unique needs of our population. Hennepin County plans to use these funds on strategies that we know will grow our affordable housing options. We'll use these funds to sustain momentum established with the pandemic era funding and to grow programs already tested through the pandemic. Over the last few years, we've more than doubled the number of units we could finance annually, and we did so while almost doubling our portion of units affordable to incomes 30% below annual median income. Housing and homeless prevention aid are critical to build upon this success. The new funding will make the rate of production and advancement of strategic initiatives the new normal. 2022 to 2023 will not just be a one-time banner moment. So here are the top four investments the new local affordable housing aid will support in Hennepin County. First, we will use almost a quarter of the funding to continue the success of our housing-based eviction prevention program. This is critical because we stood this up during the pandemic to keep people stably housed. Without this new money, we would face a rapid scaling down of this program, which is necessary to meet the continued needs of families who are struggling to keep up with their rent and struggling to stay in their homes. Second, we'll use these revenues to repair and grow the capacity of affordable housing developers and owners. You may be aware of the fact that affordable housing developers are struggling right now. Inadequate and inconsistent funding hobbled our promising developers, and the local housing aid will allow our repair and grow program to scale up so we can shore up our developers and owners who have shown a long-time commitment to creating and maintaining affordable housing in Hennepin. These new funding streams will help get them back on their feet, stable, staffed, and resourced. Third, once our affordable housing developers and owners have stabilized, we will shift into hyperdrive in our joint work to massively increase production. Following what we learned during the pandemic, we'll use a portion of the funding to develop a healthy pipeline of housing projects while also providing deeper strategic investments to provide high priority projects quickly. And finally, we'll invest the remaining funds in preservation, sustainability, and home ownership. If we learned one thing from the pandemic, is that we must invest in ways that weather uncertainty. One way we'll accomplish this is by braiding this new funding with our successful supportive housing strategic capital fund to ensure long-term sustainability of supportive housing units across the county. Multiple funding streams will help support this. And it allows us not only to scale up production in good times, but also to weather the downtimes and keep the investments going. As far as our local homeless prevention aid funds, we are working with our school and housing service providers to give direct assistance to families that have been identified as at risk of homelessness. Specifically, we've been able to partner with our Minneapolis Public Schools, funding their stable homes, stable schools program, and then creating schools to housing, which is partnering with 8 more public school districts in Hennepin County. We have also funded additional capacity in schools, specifically around their homeless and highly mobile services, and services for participating youth and families. School social workers are the ones that identify the families for the program based on their needs related to schools, such as low attendance, low proficiency in reading or math, or parents self-disclosing their housing insecurity to the social workers. Then the school and housing providers work to help the families find affordable housing or stay in their current housing and help students stay in their current districts. To see a breakdown of the budget and more information about the partners in Hennepin County, there was a PowerPoint that should be accessible to you. This program is unique because it prioritizes students that may not be eligible for other homelessness or housing support. We're able to serve families upstream in their community without them needing to enter into the shelter system. For instance, they may be doubled up are in unsafe situations, and they're able to access this funding to stabilize their housing. What we've seen is that when we're able to provide this assistance, we can avoid evictions and we can avoid families losing their housing, which drastically decreases the number of families entering shelter. Equally important is the stability it provides for students in their educational endeavors. Lastly, I'll close for some numbers. For those that are interested in more information on outcomes than beyond just our strategies, this state aid will allow us to produce 1,244 units of affordable housing on an ongoing basis, and that includes serving 750 households annually with emergency rental assistance, adding 270 new affordable rental units each year, operating 50 new and additional units of supportive housing, creating 60 new units for home ownership annually, and our local homelessness prevention aid will allow us to serve 300 to 400 families annually with longer term support up to 24 months. Again, I would just like to thank you, Chair Gomez, and members of the committee for the opportunity to share this good news with you today, and to share all of the work that Hennepin County has been doing around continuing to prevent homelessness within our community.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan, appreciate it. I know that Commissioner Conley was originally planning to join us, and she's been in front of our committee a couple times, but she wasn't able to make it, so we appreciate you pinch hitting today. Thanks. Next up is Linnea Mersch, and on deck is Trish Herron. Welcome to the committee. Please just state your name as you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Linnea Mersch, I'm the Director of Public Health and Human Services for St. Louis County. And I just have a summary of how we are beginning to use our local homeless prevention aid, not covering the statewide affordable housing aid, but happy to do my best if there's questions. So to start with, this really fits in the broader work that we are doing right now to reach housing stability for young people and with young people. And so you'll see that as a theme throughout the way that we're doing this work, really listening to community input and really listening to the capacity of providers and letting providers tell us where there are needs and using this funding as last resort to fill those gaps and to fund staff where we're not able to with other state and federal programs. So again, our approach was to do broad outreach across St. Louis County and all of our communities through youth shelters, safe spaces, our provider network, school liaisons and counselors, and just sharing information about the opportunity ahead and the opportunity to design the program and initiatives that would be funded. And so what we heard specifically was our providers wanted an open RFP so they could really compete and present really broad ideas to us for the use of these flexible funds. They really wanted us to focus on equity. They wanted it to be simple. We all manage complex programs. State and federal housing funds are very complex, and they really wanted creative opportunities to try some new things, and they wanted sustainable positions that could fill gaps. And so we're really doing that. We're coming into year two of the funding contracts and are really looking to sustain the initiative started in year one. And again, the funding is last resort. We are maximizing other state and federal sources first. So here's a few things. I won't read these. You have them in your packet, but what we heard when we asked about needs. Specifically to younger children and families, transportation, safe housing, childcare, just everything else that comes along with the housing instability that these families are facing. When we talked to the older youth, that age 18 to 24, we heard about their needs in navigating systems, in the complexities that come with the chemical and mental health challenges that they're facing, affordable housing, targeted housing for different specific population groups, disability services and needs, the job coaching, and so forth. So we also asked what's working that we can build on. And so again, we're really trying to complement what's already happening with our Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. We have some really neat providers in the St. Louis County area that are doing some really interesting programming, again, that we wanted to build upon with these funds. So we, again, committed to a direct, open, simple, straightforward process, and we really worked with our partners to emphasize collaboration versus competition with these funds. So in short, let's see. Oh, that slide's hidden. You have the slide. Right now we're highlighting four different initiatives with some of our current providers. One of them is Lutheran Social Services, which is providing tenancy-sustaining support services to young people directly. Lifehouse, which is based in the Duluth area, is also providing those support services to youth who are really at risk or experiencing homelessness. The Human Development Center, which is a certified community behavioral health center, is actually stepping into some new permanent supportive housing with targeted units serving the 18 to 24-year-old youth. And then Divine Connections is a really exciting nonprofit, newer nonprofit in our county that is providing supportive services and housing to young BIPOC families. And so both older youth and then older youth that are also parents themselves. And so in closing, Deanna Kirk, who is the director of Divine Connections, shared a story that I would love to share. Our numbers are also reported to the state, and so I can go over specific metrics of the number of people that we've served. But just one quick short story. She wanted me to share about a Native American mother that had lost custody of all three of her children due to drug use. She went to treatment and moved into Annie's house, which is one of the homes that this nonprofit operates. She immediately got her 4-year-old son back, but Annie's house was too small for her 12-year-old twins. With the same partnership, so with these funds, she moved into Wynwood, which is an apartment where she provides the supportive services. And the other two sons were returned to her, and now she is still in recovery with all three of her children in her home. She has also transitioned to a Section 8 voucher, again achieving that sustainability, and she's going to be returning this fall to work at Annie's house as an AmeriCorps resource navigator to help other moms. So thank you for the opportunity to share about what we're starting to do in St. Louis County.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for your good work and for sharing it with us today. Next up, Trish Herron. And then I have Karen Skepper and George Burrell on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Trish Herron. I'm the Moore County Administrator. And I'm here today to tell you a little bit about what we are doing with our local homeless prevention aid. So in stark contrast to the speakers who came before me, our amount of aid is $37,000 per year. But we also only have 40,000 people who live in our community. However, this $37,000 is able to make incredible impact, and I'm excited to tell you about what we are doing. So first of all, just a little bit about our county and community. In case you haven't been to Moore County or know where it is, we are in the southeastern part of the state. We're a very unique community in that we have probably one of the best cancer research centers in the nation that exists right in Austin, Minnesota. We also have biotech industries. Of course, we are home to a Fortune 500 company called Hormel. You might have heard of them. But actually, we are primarily an agriculture community. Over 50% of our value comes from farming, and that's the highest and best use of our land. We are unique also in that we are incredibly diverse. So for a rural community, we have 26% of our community is non-white. So I've been in two other counties as a county administrator, and in both of those counties, we're about 99%. So this is very different and very unique. We have 50 languages spoken in our school district. 75% of our students are eligible for free and reduced lunch, although now everybody gets fed, but that just gives you an idea of we have this amazing community, a lot of really amazing things going on, and yet we have incredible poverty. So if the national or the state average poverty is 9.6, ours is 14.4. So you can see that there's incredible need in our community. So homelessness probably looks a little different in Moore County than in other counties. So what you're going to see in Moore County is not people sitting on the streets. You're not going to see people on the corners with signs asking for money. But if you go to the library, you're going to see our library is filled every day with people who don't have a place to go during the day or during the night. So this is where they go to get any business needs taken care of and, quite frankly, just to stay warm or cool. We also have a lot of couch surfing that goes on for our students in our community. We have a few bridges, and underneath them you will find some people living there. And then we have a river that flows through Moore County, and in the summertime you'll see encampments. So it's almost, if you would ask anybody who lives in Moore County or in the city of Austin if we have any homelessness, the answer would be no, because the majority of people don't see it. But if you work in the schools, if you're a member of law enforcement, or if you're somebody that is just paying attention, you will see it. So we have a program in our community that's called No Wrong Door. So I want to share with you a map of how you get housing support in my community. It's a 8-page document front and back. I didn't present it to you, but I want to just show you this so you know the complexity of what it takes to put together all the different resources we have, from whether it is our funding that comes from the state, federal government, the Salvation Army, United Way, all the various people on this list who come together to provide resources to deal with homelessness, that it takes a navigator that is very skilled in knowing what's available to be able to find resources for people. So if you were to present to me today at our Health and Human Services Department, it could take 24 hours to a week for us to find you a place to stay at our Sterling Hotel, which is rented by the hour, or our one housing facility that is only for men. You will for sure get bed bugs there. You will also be subject to violence and drugs. So there's just not a lot of options. But we are doing our best to unite, to come together, to provide the housing response that we can. So this is our map. I was able to take the 8 pages and put them into some kind of a map that you could maybe see. So it looks a little better this way. We are really trying to do these wraparound services, and we have a vision for providing housing stabilization. And our most powerful tool really is our collaboration. It's really getting people around the table from Salvation Army, from the HRA, from IMS, from all the different providers, and coming together to figure out how can we take the small resources that we each get to make a big impact in our community. So with our homeless prevention aid, and why it matters to us is that this is the first time we have ever received any aid that we actually had control over that we could use immediately. So if we have a social worker in the school district that says, I have a child in my office, student in my office, who's reporting that they're being evicted or that they have been evicted, they're living in their car, we are able to get a voucher to the school and to that family in the same day. That is, we've never been able to do that because it takes us 2 weeks to cut a check at the county. You know, we can't just respond. So this, it seems like a small amount of money compared to what other counties are getting, but this has a huge impact on us. So it's a way for us to provide this immediate assistance to these mostly invisible homeless people in our partnerships with schools and our county home facilitators. So thank you. Before I get pretty excited about this, so before I move on, I want to say thank you so much for appropriating this money. So we do have success stories, and I do just want to share one because this is kind of how homelessness presents to us. So we had a family that was reported to us from law enforcement. They were found to be staying in an RV in an empty parking lot in our community. They contacted law enforcement and originally went up to this RV because it was leaking fluids and it was causing an environmental concern. So they're in essence breaking the law. So APD went up to them, was going to cite them and get them moved off, but instead they saw that there were children inside this RV. So they contacted us, and we were able to bring our child protection team and do an assessment. And instead of going down the child protection path, we went down a homelessness path. And to make a very long story short, we were able to get this family into temporary housing, and they are now in permanent sustainable housing. And it was thanks to the funding that we have received. So I do want to just quickly speak to the fact that while we are really happy, there are gaps, and I hope you continue to fight for funding that we can use at the local level, where we can make these local independent decisions. We live in a transportation desert. So if you have to go to 5 places to get funding or to figure out where you're supposed to go, you might not be able to do that, because if you don't have a car, it can be long distances. We don't have places to house people. As I said before, we have 2 short-term places. One, again, is a hotel that rents by the hour, and the other a place you probably wouldn't allow your dog to stay in. Those are challenges, and that's for another committee meeting and another story. But I just wanted you to know that we're doing the best we can with the money that has been appropriated, and we are very, very grateful. So with that, do you have any questions?
Thank you very much for your presentation. I know that Lee David's part of his district, at least, is in Maurer County, so I'm going to make sure to send him your clip of your presentation, because I know that, you know, he served with us on the Preventing Homelessness Committee before, which is sort of where these dollars originated in a way, and so we're just really grateful for just to hear a little bit more about some of the challenges you're facing and some of the successes that you've had. So thank you so much for that story.
Thank you.
And if you wouldn't mind sticking around, just around in case we have questions for you when we switch to that section. So Karen Skepper and George Burrell, welcome to the committee. Please just, as you're getting started with your testimony, introduce yourselves for the record, if you don't mind.
Good afternoon, Chair Gomez and committee members. My name is Karen Stepper. I am the Director of Community and Government Relations for Anoka County. I'm here today with my colleague, George Burrell, who will help me talk about how we're using the local homeless prevention aid. We know that this was created to benefit persons who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, and we're finding ways to take what used to be a Band-Aid fix and try to find some permanent solutions. I also want to express the gratitude of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners. They couldn't be here today, but they did want me to express how grateful they are for this local housing assistance or the homeless assistance. In 2023 and 2024, we've received just over $1.7 million each year. This is a huge increase from what we used to see. It was maybe 15 years ago when our only resource was family homeless prevention funds, and I remember when that was $170,000, period. We now have resources to actually do something and make a difference. We have a goal of ensuring that no child is homeless and that by using these funds we can keep families either in their housing or get them rapidly rehoused. I think for the sake of time, I'm going to turn it over to George. He can talk about some of the actual programs we're administering, and then I'll wrap it up again with a story that I think is very significant.
Great. Mr. Burrell, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Karen. Chair Gomez, committee members, thank you for having us, and thank you for these funds and their flexibility. I think you've heard from others on how much they appreciate the broad range that we're able to use these funds and really stretch into areas that we haven't been able to before. We had created a work group a little over a year ago to figure out what to do with these funds. We engaged with all of our school districts and charter schools. We did listening sessions. We did surveys. We partnered with our Heading Home partners to figure out what were some of the areas where we could start to fill some gaps with this flexible funding. One of the first things that we heard from were the school districts about how they were seeing homelessness come into the school, how they were identifying it with their students, with the parents coming in that needed very quick assistance and didn't know where else to go, and there really wasn't much that the schools could do. Some of the school districts had a few more resources, and others had little to none, and we're just trying to put things together. One of the initiatives that we've started is providing direct assistance funding to 8 of our school districts that had requested it. We are able to provide them with funding, so when families come in and present an issue regarding their housing, regarding potential evictions, behind on rent, they can identify those and they can take care of those things immediately. I can appreciate that it does take a while to get the county to cut a check. We're a government. The school districts are able to do this much faster and be accountable for the funding. The partnership with that has been amazing, and we are very happy that the school districts are willing to take this on and start to identify some of the service needs and also to reach back out to us regarding other additional things with mental health needs that some of the families have. One of our programs that we started just prior to the pandemic was a very small housing resource team that was partially funded by the Department of Human Services. We were able to expand that team, which encompasses our housing help desk, which gets thousands of calls every year of people looking for rental assistance, how to navigate their way through the system. They also provide outreach services and consultation to other providers. They also run a hotel shelter program that we started during the pandemic with emergency funding. That funding has sunsetted. This funding has allowed us to continue to do that and provide much needed, especially family shelter within Anoka County. We have also added to our pot of emergency assistance funding with our Economic Assistance Department. The funding only goes so far, and they were having to turn families away. This was able to bolster that and provide additional upfront funding through our existing system. We also expanded our homeless outreach team. This is with a contracted provider in the community that was very, very small. We had 0.5 FTE of a homeless outreach person for many, many years in Anoka County. We are now up to a team of six. And part of the funding comes from this funding, and other funding comes from Department of Human Services. With all of these programs, we have also added in direct assistance funding. So much like the schools, these programs are able to directly address some of the immediate needs that the families have. We expanded our youth outreach with our local youth drop-in center. And one of the more experimental programs that we've expanded on is our partnership through child protection with parent support outreach. We had identified during the pandemic, as we partnered to support families in hotel shelters, that these were families that were connected to child protection, most on a voluntary basis, but they needed lots of assistance. We were able to use these funds to provide additional funds for the service provider that does PSEP services for Anoka County to be able to provide families with additional supports and to be able to help them leverage getting and sustaining being in housing. Very time-intensive program, and they were more than excited to be able to partner with us and grow this great opportunity. Time-wise, I'm going to kick it back to Karen. So, thank you.
Thank you. When I started, I talked a little bit about how we've had temporary Band-Aid solutions to fix emergency problems. By having access to this homeless aid as well as the local housing aid, we have been able to have broad discussions in our community and have now in process purchasing what was a boarded up, decommissioned board and lodge facility. Yes. And take that... listening to the community, we'll be renovating that into 1, 2, 3, and 4 bedroom units. Both, we know there's a need for single units. We also know there's a need for large family. So we'll be using a lot of these aids to facilitate that project. We'll attach a rental assistance subsidy to it to keep it affordable long term. And we believe that this is really our first step into finding those end solutions, so we don't have to go back and try to keep fixing the same problem over and over and over again. Thank you very much for having us here today.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks for your work and for sharing sharing it with us. Finally, Mr. Hilgart is going to wrap us up, I think, on the community testimony that I've signed up. So welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. And I know that's a lot, so I just wanted to kind of end it with a summarized version of what we've heard from all of our 87 counties for takeaways for you all. And thank you for dedicating, frankly, half of a committee hearing for this. This was really important. In 2021, this was you, Madam Chair, that was pushing this hard, but it was others. This was bipartisan. It was in a bipartisan tax bill. It was talked about in a bipartisan fashion, and then Chair Markwart also helped push this through at the end. So I want to thank you all for that. I want to focus my testimony on a few takeaways from our great presenters. The first is that it's our fervent hope that as you leave today, our presentations have underscored that homelessness is a statewide issue and a statewide crisis. The curation of county examples that we heard today from a metro, suburban, and rural county were purposeful. It's meant to illustrate that while homelessness may present itself differently and at different levels of visibility across our state, it is there, it is pervasive, and it is not relenting at the pace that we would like, all of us would like. The second that I want to talk about is flexibility is key, and I think you heard that from our testifiers today. Emergency assistance, rental support, hotel vouchers, school counselors, social workers to identify and pay for rent, parental support outreach programs, expanding permanent family supportive housing unit, paying for utilities, past rent, security deposits, or more. Each county that responded to our survey is doing a variety of things. But thanks to what you've done, which is providing flexibility, they're able to meet their residents where their needs are at. When we passed this bill, counties also testified with humility that we recognize we might not be the best person to spend these funds. And so I want to actually give a huge shout out to the providers and schools and nonprofits and faith-based organizations and continuum of care organizations that are our partners in this. So when you hear this, yes, we administer these funds. Yes, we might actually do some of this work ourselves, but we're also partnering with those local government, local community organizations. And third, we want to make sure that this program doesn't operate in a silo. Counties operate in an array of programs that also assist with homelessness issues, along with newly created programs from the 2023 session, such as the statewide affordable housing program, the challenge program, workforce and affordable home ownership program, FHPAP, and more. We are grateful for those programs, and we are grateful for your state partnership. And I think one of the biggest barometers of our success moving forward will be how counties use to complement these programs. And I think you heard a lot of that from the testimony today. We're not just looking at homelessness prevention aid in a silo. We're seeing how we can partner this with our federal programs, our state programs, our LAHA and SAHA dollars for the acronyms of people who are following those, and an array of investments that you made last year. Emergency assistance is great and needed, but we all yearn for the day when housing stability is the reality and the need for ESP and EGA and rental assistance is even diminished. We know we can't do this alone, and we are thankful for your state partnership, and that brings me to our final point. And I know, Madam Chair, you won't shy away from this one, which is to tell us where we can do better and tell us where you think that we can tell us where you think that we, if you're listening to our programs and saying, yes, this is exactly where the intent was, this is where the focus is, please tell us that. And I know, Chair Gomez, you've been on webinars with our members. We've been asking you for feedback, and we want that dialogue to continue. This is a six-year program. We're going into year two of it. We think it's tremendously important, and we want to share these stories and also get that feedback from you as we continue to make plans for these spending areas. So thank you very much for your time today on this really important issue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hilgart, and also just for all of your help over the years of getting this up and running, and you've been amazing. So we're going to move to member discussion. First up, Representative Joaquin.
Sorry, thank you. thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you to the counties and all the work you're doing, especially around partnering with our school districts. We know kids learn better when they know where they're going to sleep at night. And seeing that partnership is amazing, and I know we still have a lot of work to do. I would love to, in the future, too, find out how you're partnering with cities as well, the counties are, when it comes to developing further those units of affordable housing, because I know it literally takes every level of government to get some of those projects off the ground. So I just want to say thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And I'm wondering if my friends from Anoka County could come down just briefly.
Come on down.
In the interest of time, while they're coming down, I'll begin by just thanking you for the work that you've been doing in our county. I was really impressed in particular with how community-driven the process has been, the engagement you did with the schools. Was really excited about a lot of the ideas that I heard, the hotel shelter that you're able to continue doing. The idea that in a county that's been growing as quickly as ours that we only had half an FTE working on homelessness prevention and outreach, I mean, that's crazy. And so to be able to scale that up to now have a team of six is amazing. That new shelter project that you mentioned is great. The testifier from Mower County or Mower County said that the homelessness is there, you just don't see it. And in what I think we've been experiencing in Anoka County, at least in my part of the county, is that we're starting to see it more. It's long been there in Anoka County, but we're starting to see it more. And as a result, my constituents are talking about it more, and they're coming to me and saying, what can we do about homelessness? At the same time, I hear from them about our property taxes going up significantly. And so you kind of, hinted at this in your testimony, but I'm wondering if you could kind of boil it down to, how has this aid enabled the county to implement some services and strategies to tackle this homelessness issue that we're seeing in our county while also, avoiding having to increase the property tax levy in the process?
Mr. Skepper or Ms.
Skepper or Mr. Burrell, either of you are welcome to answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will start this off. George is welcome to join in at any point. Keeping property taxes low is important to Anoka County. Providing services is also very important, and it's a really delicate balancing act. The really easy first step is that we were well organized. We have good relationships with our providers. We work with them through FHPAP. I work through many of the community organizations as I administer the federal block grant programs. So we have the structure there. By actually starting to do surveys, listening to people, getting the feedback, that put us on the right track, and we were able to move quickly. By taking those activities that were high priority, we knew we were missing large bedroom units that were affordable. That helped my department start looking for an apartment building. After over a year of searching, we happened upon this decommissioned board and lodge facility, which turns out to be perfect. I know George has done the same by listening and keeping those close community connections. You learn a lot. And it's, I think, those community connections that have helped us get these programs up, running, and yet keep our property taxes low.
Thank you, Ms. Skepper.
Thank you.
Great. You good, Representative Norris? All right. Wonderful. Thanks for being here. So, Representative Listegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, because for a time, I just want to comment on all the testifiers that I could hear and see the compassion in their work, that they truly do want to improve people's lives and people that are really struggling and stuff like that. And St. Louis County, you do an incredible job, you and your staff, and I've seen it. I've seen the results, and I just want to commend you for everything that you do. So thank you.
Thank you. I know we're running out of time, but Representative Brand texted me during this hearing, was like, wait, are we talking about Homework Starts with Home or the local housing or the local homelessness aid? And I was like, very good catch, Representative Brand, because the way that this started was, you know, looking at that program and seeing, you know, to chair you Akeem's point, right? If kids don't know where they're going to lay their head at night, they cannot learn. And I just firmly believe that, you know, in a prosperous state in the richest country that's ever existed on the face of the earth, nobody should be homeless. And certainly we should be able to agree and to align our resources so that no child who are our future, who are being educated in our schools, should be homeless. And so, you know, I looked at the success of that program and I said, how do we scale this up so that it hits every one of these kids? And what it would have taken is about $100 million a year. We got 20, you know, and we can see, we can hear from our partners, from our local partners, you know, the magic that they're making happen with a little bit of money in some cases. And, you know, and so I just am really grateful. I'm really like, I'm moved hearing from you all today because this is, you know, I do view this as a sort of a Gomez Marquardt joint, because I was like, I came with this like kind of prescriptive Homework Starts with Home on the county level thing. And he was like, we have to give these folks the flexibility that they need to meet their local communities where they are. And so I it really is an example of where, like, you know, then Chair Marquardt buying into this program really made it better. And you guys are just demonstrating, you know, that providing our local partners who, to Chair Listegard's point, who have the care, who have the love for their people that they're serving, and when we give them the resources that they need, we can really do amazing things for people. And so I'm so grateful to you all for being here. And I'm hopeful that we can, hey, we spend $100 million a year on a lot of stuff. And I really and truly believe that we can end child homelessness in Minnesota, and that it's not like an out of control, it's not an out of reach goal. And I hope that, you know, that we can, that this is not a partisan issue as we were talking about, that we really can do this. And so I think this is an important step, and I hope that we're able to, over time, to get to that point. So thank you. Sorry, I just
took a little license. Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I want to thank all the testifiers. Being a former police officer, you're out on the street, and it's 11 o'clock at night, and you need a resource. And you guys are always there to help us. And so thank you for that. And the one thing I heard, I think, George from Anoka County, I think the chair just said it, when we give you that flexibility and trust the people, the boots on the ground, you guys do amazing things. And I think that's important. So thank you. Keep up the work. And it definitely does make an impact in our communities.
Wonderful note to end on. Thank you, Representative Witte. So our next meeting will be Tuesday, March 26th at 1 p.m. And seeing nothing else, with that, we are adjourned.